Mr. Mercy rolled 6.
As I say, I went back into the compound again to join up with the rest of the ship's company. And life went on very much day to day from then onwards until we started to think that we were not getting all the rations that we should do from the Germans. So one or two of us started to ferret around. And to cut a long story short, we discovered that the regimental sergeant majors in the camp were running a racket with the German guards, flogging our rations to the guards to get from the guards booze which they had pinched from their officers' mess. When we discovered this, we didn't go much on it. And so we asked to see the senior British regimental sergeant major and the German commandant. And they allowed us to do this. And we put our complaint forward to the German commandant. And we could see that he was very uncomfortable, and the regimental sergeant major's face went a deep purple. And they realised that they'd been found out. So, by this time, there were only 28 of HMS Bedouin's crew left in Lambsdorff. They were the chiefs and POs. We, having found this racket out, it certainly didn't please the regimental sergeant majors, because the information was getting around the camp and they weren't being looked on very favourably at all. And the Germans didn't like it, because they didn't like to think that somebody was getting one over on them and that they could be bribed. Well, not long after that, the Germans decided that we should be shifted from Lambsdorff and sent to Marlag und Milag Nord at Westertimkar.
Perhaps before we go on to that, could I just ask you about something you said earlier, yes, that your friend Pilcher was a policeman in the camp. Could you tell me a little bit more about that system?
Well, I didn't know an awful lot about it, but as far as I could make out, the camp Polizei, which were the British people, were brought into being to control and discipline the camp inmates. As I said before, in the case of the Glaswegians, for instance, there were always a lot of fights and quarrelling and knifings and that sort of thing in their compound. And, of course, under circumstances like this, in a prisoner of war camp, tempers do become frayed very easily. And in a big Arbeitskommando like Lambsdorff, where there were all 5,000 people at least, fights were quite common. And so these camp Polizei, one of their duties was to break up such things or to prevent them happening. And this was all laid on by the senior British regimental sergeant major and his satellites, part of their code of discipline, so to speak. And there was no collaboration with the Germans in this, as far as I know. It was purely and simply for that reason, to keep discipline and harmony in the camp, to stop fighting and quarrelling among the inmates and the men. So, does that explain it
to
you?
That's fine.
Good.
Can we pick up from where you said you were then going off to Westertimkar?
All right. The Germans decided to send us into Germany, to Marlag. So, once again, we were marched down to the station. There were the cattle wagons once more, but this time they had bales of straw in them. We only had one cattle wagon, because there were only 28 of us left, and we easily fitted into that. But there was the old bucket on the hook, up in the deckhead there, urine bucket. and we
got into the cattle wagon. We were duly locked in.
It was early December by this time, and it was cold. It was about 3 feet of snow on the deck. And away we went, while we were in the cattle wagon being transported round various parts of Germany. One place I know we went through was Dresden. And we were 7 days on this trip until we got to Bremen. At Bremen we were loaded into lorries and we were taken out to Marlag at Vestertimke. it was about 15 kilometres from Bremen and we arrived there on the 18th of December. Now, Marlag was the one and only naval camp that the Germans had managed to fill. Apparently, so we were told, they had built 3 naval camps, expecting a big influx of sailors, but they could only just about fill Marlag. But Marlag, the senior British officer there, in the officer's compound, was a Captain Baker. And he was a Pucker RN naval officer. In the ratings compound, there was a senior chief petty officer by the name of Gissing. We always called him Von Gissing.
Called him what?
Von Gissing. the camp was run on naval lines. We knew where we were. We knew where we stood. We knew what the routine was. We knew what to expect. We were happy. Marlag was the place we'd been looking for about 18 months. And part of the routine in Marlag was, as on a ship or in any naval establishment, Saturday morning routine. All the furniture and bunks were chucked out of the hut. The tables, the stools, everything. Buckets of water, they were all scrubbed down, all cleaned up nicely, place swept out, deck scrubbed, so on and so forth. And everything was shipshape and Bristol fashion, as it always had been in the Navy, as we'd been trained to do. Therefore, we never suffered with any lice, and we certainly never suffered with any bedbugs. Now, attached to Marlag and Milag was another lag called Dulag. And this was an interrogation camp through which everybody had to pass, and it was run by the Gestapo. And the chap in charge of it was a horrible piece of work by the name of Schuf. Now, when you were interrogated in Dulag, you went into a white-tiled room, very much like a public toilet in this country, at one end of which was a wooden table behind which sat 4 German Gestapo men. Behind them, directed on you, were 4 arc lights. At the back of you stood on each side a German guard. You were sat in a chair, and these 4 Gestapo idiots would fire questions at you. You couldn't see them. You were blinded by the arc lights. But they fired questions at you, one after the other, in quick succession, jumping from one thing to the other, hoping to utterly confuse you so that you would let something slip. Well, now, one has got to remember that we had been out of the war for some 18 months. But in the case of people like signalmen and telegraphists, torpedomen and myself, we were given rather more of the third degree treatment than the rest of the ship's company. Firstly, because signalmen and telegraphists used code books, obviously, for coding messages and making their signals. The torpedomen, working with torpedoes, the Germans hoped to get the latest guff on those. In my own case, being a writer, because they're not dumb, these Germans, you know, they knew a lot about our navy as we did about theirs. In my case, being a writer, they obviously said to themselves, ah, he's going to be mixed up with ciphering and coding. They couldn't have been more wrong, because I wasn't. The schoolmaster used to do it. However, I got an awful lot of questions along these lines in the hope that they would trip me up into letting something slip. But of course they got nothing out of me because I had nothing to give. My action station was on the plot, navigating. I had nothing to do with coding and ciphering. As far as I know, they got nothing out of the signalmen, torpedomen or telegraphists. And even if they had, it would have been way out of date, as I've just said. We'd been out of the war for some 18 months. Things had progressed since then. So they wouldn't have been up to date. Wouldn't have been much use, even if they had got some information.
Apart from those methods of quick questioning and shining of lights in your face, did they use any other third-degree methods?
Well, you got the odd bat around the head, you know, and that sort of thing. Nothing too drastic, actually, strangely enough.
And how did people stand up to it?
Oh, very well. In fact, we treated it very much as a skylark, really, because they were just wasting their time, purely and simply. As I've said, we had nothing of any use that we could tell them, even if we wanted to, having been out of the war for 18 months.
How long would each individual be in there?
Well, it depended entirely upon the way the interview was going. Myself, I was in there about 2 hours. As long as that. The torpedomen weren't in there, I don't think, quite as long. The telegraphist got rather a bashing verbally. The signalmen weren't in quite so long. But I was in there for 2 hours, that I remember.
How did you get to know that the chap in charge was called Schoof?
Oh, because he was always around and we got to know him very well in the camp. He was in and out all day long, every day. It was only a short walk from Dulag down to the main camp, you see. And Schoof and his boys were always snooping in the camp, hoping to find radios or contraband or anything else that they could lay their hands on where we had been naughty boys, and which would give him an excuse to punish us. So he was in there every day. Now, some while ago, when we were in Lambsdorff, I said that I'd collected five verrucas on my left heel. Well, now, I attended the sick bay in Marlag, and the doctor there gave me the same treatment as the one had in Lambsdorff, with a silver nitrate pencil, trying to burn these things out. Well, they became so painful, I pleaded with him to cut them out. He wouldn't do this, until eventually I must have worn him down, and he agreed to do it. So, duly, a date was set. I reported at the sick bay. There was a wooden trestle table in there, about 6 feet long. And he said, hop up onto that, face down, which I did, and our sick berth PO was there. That is the ship's sick berth PO. I laid face down. He said, put your arms down by your side, which I did. Spread your legs slightly apart, which I did. And then before I knew it, there was a strap round my legs and a strap round my arms and I just couldn't move. And I said, what's the idea of this then? So Doc Rutherford, our sick berth PO, he said, you'll find out, Bert, soon enough. I said, all right. Then the doctor came in and he said, Macy, you've asked me time and time again to cut these verrucas out for you. He said, well, now I'm going to do it. But I'll tell you why I've been very loath to do it. He said, I've got no anaesthetics. The only anaesthetic I've got is a couple of shots of cocaine, which I've half-hitched from the dentist over in the officer's compound. He said, so do you still want me to go ahead? So I said, yes, please. I've put up with these long enough. I don't mind how much it hurts. Please get rid of them. I can't take any more. So he said, right. He got the hypodermic. He shoved it in a couple of times in my heel, got his scalpel, and then started cutting. Now, this was winter. It was mighty cold. But Macy sweat drops of neaters. I didn't yell, and I couldn't move. But God, was it painful. Anyway, he cut them out. A piece of flesh about 3/4 inch deep, 1/2 inch wide, and about 1 inch long. And when he cut these things out, he put them in a jar and he showed them to me. He said, there you are. The next problem was, he hadn't got any thread to stitch me up again. So he said to Rutherford, nip over to the theatre, will you, P.O.? The theatre was opposite the sick bay. He said, and get me a violin E string. So Rutherford went over there, came back with a violin E string. He threaded that through a needle and he stitched me up with that. And strangely enough, it worked. There was no infection. For 3 weeks, I was in bed, off my foot. But it all healed up beautifully, and I've never had any trouble from that day to this. Marvellous. Wonderful what you can do when you have to. Now, I was wandering around the compound one day, and I was passing the theatre, and I heard people singing and the music of the Mikado coming out of the theatre. So being a nosy sort of a blighter, I went into the theatre and stood around listening and watching the rehearsal going on. They were producing the Mikado. After a little while, a chap came up to me and he said, you interested in this sort of thing? So I said, well, yes, to some extent, I suppose. I said, when we were down in Italy, we did the Mikado as best we could. He said, oh, you know this then? So I said, yes. He said, right, well, you're just the boy we're looking for. How about playing Peepbo? I thought, jumping Jiminy. Me playing a female? So he said, well, you're the right build. I was then. I was nice and slim in all the right places. Not as I am now. Nice and fat in all the wrong places. And I said, all right, I don't mind having a go then. So I was roped in to do the part of Peepbo, one of the three little maids. Well, now, if any of you have ever seen the Mikado, you will know that it's a very colourful show. To put a show like that on in a prisoner of war camp, where you had very little to make costumes with, and Japanese costumes in particular, it was going to be quite a headache to costume it. Scenery was all right. We could build that up from Red Cross packing cases that the parcels came in. But the costumes was a headache. So somebody hit on the bright idea of asking the Red Cross to send us a load of coloured crepe paper and coloured cellophane. They did. And Crepe paper, being what it is very colourful, and so is the cellophane. You've all seen it, I expect. Probably all use it at Christmas time or at school or something like that. So our tailors got to work in making the kimonos. And they reinforced the seams with bandages, which they purloined from the sick bay. Now, the next problem to overcome were the headdresses. And you probably all know what a Japanese girl's headdress looks like, a geisha girl's headdress or hair. What we did, we went to the fire reservoir, which had a lot of mud in it, and we scooped out the mud and we dried it until it was sort of semi-malleable, and then we shaped it into the shape of a geisha girl's head hair. And we did the same, which of course was easier for the men. And when it was completely dried out in the sun, we smoothed it all off and made it look nice and tiddly. Then we went down to the library and we got old library books and some paste, and we took the pages out of the library book, cut them up into 1-inch wide slips of paper, and we pasted these over these mud casts of both the girls and the men's. When that was dry, we then got black crepe paper and we pasted that onto the girls' mud cast. The men's was painted with a sort of yellow ochre paint, which we had to make up again. But the main problem was the girls' headdress. We got the black crepe paper pasted on. Then when that was all dry, the paper cast was taken off the mud mould and it was cut down the centre, and each man who was playing a girl's part had his headdress fitted, and each man had his headdress fitted, so they all fitted perfectly and each had his own throughout the whole show. The next problem to be overcome were the fans. Now in the Mikado, if you know the Mikado at all, the movements of the fans mean things, particularly in the instance of when Pish Tush is singing his patter song at the beginning of the Mikado, and the patter song sets the scene for the whole of the show, and his fan movements have to be done in such a way that they cannot be mistaken by the audience. Now, since having done Peep Bow in Marlag, I've done the Mikado again, and I did it as Pish Tush only a few years ago. So I know what I'm talking about. So we had to make fans. Well, what we did was to get the Red Cross cases that the Red Cross parcels came in, and we took them apart. They were made of 3-ply wood. We soaked the wood in the fire reservoir until the laminations came apart, and we stripped them down, and then we shaped each thin lamination into a piece of the fan. These were then all put together so that they move very easily, and one or two of the artists in the camp then painted Japanese pictures on each side of the fan, for every man and every girl that was taking part. So we got that problem out of the way. The next one was the sandals. Well, this didn't prove to be too much of a problem because we got the string from the Red Cross parcels. We plaited this and shaped it into sandals. So we had nice little Japanese sandals. Now, when it came to putting the show on, as you can imagine, with the costumes made from paper and with all the rough knocking about on the stage that they would get, they got torn and that sort of thing. So every morning after the previous night's show, we had to go over to the theatre and patch all the costumes up. And this show lasted for a fortnight, like all the rest of them did. So it was quite a marathon task, keeping these costumes in a reasonable condition for the next night's show throughout the whole fortnight. Well, now, in Marlag, we put on a lot of shows, mostly musical ones, because the officers did all the drama because they hadn't got any singers, whereas we got the singers, so we did the musicals. Now, when we put a musical on, the officers were allowed to come over into our compound and we put on a show for them, specially, as we did for the German guards and censor girls. And in our theatre, we had built up the seating so that it was on a sloping basis. Those at the back could see just as well as those at the front. It was built on a tier basis, which we had to take down after every show, admittedly, but it was quite easy to put up and take down again. The Jerrys gave us all the planks and so on. Now, we put on a number of shows there, including the Student Prince, HMS Pinafore, Ialanthe, Merry England. I was in them all. There were two opera companies, and I was in both, so I was kept pretty busy one way and the other. And as I said earlier, we used to put on a show for the German guards and commandant and censor girls. That was the only form of entertainment that they had. Now, not long after we had arrived in Marlag, the commandant was changed. The one who was there when we arrived was a, what we call in the Navy, a big, fat, ugly, bubbly, what name. But his relief was a Captain Rogger, and he was a naval officer, a member of the Kriegsmarine. And he was a thoroughly nice chap. He said to us when he joined and he got us all together, he said, "Now look, I am going to make your life as easy as I can here, because in the 1418 war, I was a prisoner in your country at Darlington Hall. So I know what it's like to be a prisoner of war, and I know what you're going through now. So wherever I can, I will make your life as easy as possible." And he was as good as his word. He did just that. Life could have been a lot worse under his predecessor, but he disobeyed orders which were received from the German High Command in Berlin. He disobeyed them until he was found out by Schuf and his gang.